Let's see, who just came in? Your name is...
Harry Wilson.
Willis. We'll continue on with atomic structure. We need to take a little sidetrack to discuss the subject of particles and waves. I think you already know that when scientists tried to study matter in finer and finer detail, they would do some experiments that would seem to indicate that the finer you divided matter, the smaller things got, that in some experiments light would behave as though it were a particle, but in some experiments it would behave as though it were a wave. Einstein's equation, which we already know, which says energy is equal to the mass of something times the velocity of light squared, was known in 1905, from that time forth. And in the 20s, a fellow by the name of de Broglie, whom I have already mentioned, tried to resolve the problem, a mental problem, of trying to visualize whether something is a particle or a wave by combining in a mathematical equation the properties of particles and waves. So then your mind can forget about the paradox and it's in the mathematics, which doesn't care whether there's a paradox or not. So he used as a starting place in his equation, Einstein's equation.
Now, what was his fellow's name?
De Broglie. B-R-O-G-L-I-E. D-E-B-R-O-G-L-I-E. Now, I think that happened in the 20s when he did that. Now, there's another equation that was already known concerning radiant energy. Radiant energy we think of as energy, you could extend it to a broader definition, but radiant energy is generally thought of as energy that your eye can see, or that you can feel. You can feel heat with your skin, for example, that radiates from a fireplace to you. There's an equation due to Planck, Max Planck. Maybe I ought to write these names down. Einstein. Let's write Max Planck down next. If you want to know Einstein's first name, it was Albert. And de Broglie's first name was Lewis. Imagine that was the spellings. Max Planck said that radiant energy could be measured in terms of a constant H, which is known as Planck's constant. It's a universal constant, times the frequency of that energy. We have a number of so-called universal constants in science. The insights and intuition and guesses that went into some of these things initially, we can't take time to discuss. We'll just have to say that there are certain universal constants, at least for the moment. This constant H of Planck's, which tells you what the energy is if you know the frequency, appears time and time again in theoretical science, be it physics or chemistry or whatnot. That equation tells you that the higher the radiation, or the higher the frequency, the faster the radiation. I'll get it straight yet. This Greek letter nu indicates the frequency. That's the universal symbol in science for frequency. The higher the frequency, that means the more of these wave crests that come by some measuring point per second, the higher the energy associated with the radiation. Now, red light has a lower frequency than violet. So violet light has a higher energy content than does red light. And I have to say per photon. And I hate to say that because that has to get me into another kind of business. But say everything else being equal, let's say it that way, everything else being equal, the higher the frequency, the greater the energy content. So violet has a higher frequency than red, so there's a higher energy content here. Radio waves are lower frequency than red, and so they have a lower energy. X-rays, on the other hand, have a higher frequency than violet light, so they have greater energy. And that makes sense to your common sense, because see, X-rays can pass through your hand. And wouldn't it make sense that they must somehow have higher energy if they can get through your hand?
Radio waves do too.
All right. Army's freshmen, they wreck all your arguments. You're not a freshman, you're part of the team. Let's see. The radio wave is a longer wavelength than your hand and sort of goes around it, so to speak.
Well, if you got a radio inside a room, it's coming through the walls.
Yeah, that is true. That is true.
If it goes around the room, through the window.
It's smart.
Crawls in the same way the termites
came in. Like those smart lights in Los Angeles. They put some smart lights on that 12th North. I get so frustrated when I drive down that street. I hit every red light. Doesn't matter whether I drive it 100 times or what. Today I was driving down there and I decided, boy, I'm going to get in this car as fast as I can because I was in the first light and it turned green and I was ready. I was just zip and I got down the next one and it was red. You just cannot make it.
This morning I was red at the same time.
That's you tell me.
They sure ought to fix that. That's terrible. I've been going to complain to somebody, but I haven't.
You can hit them all green on a bike.
Bet you can do it walking, too. Well, you got me. I don't know what to tell you for a minute. This business of the frequency, see, if the frequency is the same dimension as some gap, like in a grating, then you get some kind of an interaction. If your wavelength is long compared to a gap, I'm talking about a grating, you know, where you scrape away the aluminum on glass, or in radar, the grating can just be some rods, or just a mesh or a network. If this wavelength is longer, and sometimes it only needs to be about four times as long, then it sees that as a reflector, just like ordinary light hits a mirror and bounces back as a reflector. But now let's see.
You say something like exposing film.
The radio wave, or like KSL, I forget the wavelength there, but it must be at least 100 feet. Quite a long line.
It's more than that.
And so if this argument...
200 meters, about that.
200 meters? So it's 600 feet, maybe. Pretty long, anyway. Well, I don't know. Why don't you look that up and bring us your report next time? I won't get around to doing it.
My radio waves can go through people.
Yeah. Because what I've been telling you is not entirely true, if that is so. I really never stopped to raise that question in my own mind. It's a good thing. Are you in electronics? somewhere?
No, I'm in computer science.
You're in computer science. Anybody here that's in electronics or electrical engineering? Well, why don't you look into that and remind me next Monday that you're going to give us a report, or else if you couldn't find out that you need some extra time or something. I'd like to know the answer to that, too. I don't know. I don't know the answer to that. Of course, steel will usually stop radio waves. And yet, my transistor radio will operate inside steel buildings here on campus. You know, you go under a bridge on a highway and your car radio dims. See, the bridge is mostly steel. It has iron rods in there packed awfully close together and then concrete around it. But just that steel will insulate you. I wondered, in the case of sheds, if you take a screen and put it all the way around your radio so that there's good electrical connection all the way around, in theory, the radio waves aren't supposed to be able to get in there. I think it has something to do with how good an electrical conductor the thing is in the case of radio waves. That may be a special situation. I don't know. That may make a special exception that we have to make to this general rule I've been trying to give you about. A wavelength being approximately the same length as some discontinuity, then you have a diffraction effect. All right, if we take this equation of Planck for radiation and combine it with this equation, you see, both of these are equal to energy. So if I equate those two, then I will have mc squared equals h mu. Now there's another equation which relates the wavelength and the frequency. And we've had that on the board sometime before, and that is that the velocity of light is equal to the frequency times the wavelength. Does that have the right units? The higher the wavelength, the shorter the frequency, and they must be equal to, in the case of electromagnetic radiation, like light, X-rays, infrared radiation, like from a hot iron or fireplace or whatnot, that has to travel the speed of light in a vacuum. This formula is not an invented formula, such as these things of Einstein and de Broglie. This is a common sense formula. You would arrive at that from the idea of a wave going by a point. All right, now let's combine this with this. And I guess the thing that I will do is substitute. Not sure what I want to do. Let's see. Let's get rid of the frequency out of that equation right there. So let's rearrange this one. We'll multiply, we'll divide both sides by lambda and obtain the expression that the frequency is equal to c divided by lambda. Then we substitute this nu for that nu, and we will have mc squared equals h c over lambda, and one of these c's can cancel that c. I'll cross that out. So now I have m c equals h over lambda, and I think that's de Broglie's equation, but they may give it in a different form. Let me see. Equals h over mc. Well, that's it. You could rearrange that. We could say lambda equals h over mc, same thing. I guess this is the way it is usually given in a text. Now, you see, wavelength depends on the mass. These are constants. You see, h over c is just a constant of some kind. It's the speed of light, a universal constant, and Planck's constant, a universal constant. So this tells you the larger the mass, the smaller the wavelength. And theoretical scientists think that this equation is true. For baseballs, Earths, suns, doesn't matter what the size. And the reason they get away with thinking it's true is because you can't measure it for a baseball. If you put the appropriate units in here and the weight of a baseball in for the mass, the wavelength comes out to be shorter than the diameter of the baseball. In other words, the baseball is about that size. And that equation tells you the wavelength, be the distance between the crest on the waves, it's so short you couldn't possibly measure it with anything that man knows. And to me that's nonsense, so I don't believe that formula covers all the cases. Like, how could the wavelength be smaller than the size of the thing? But that's what that equation tells you. But if you get down to electrons in size, or protons, atomic particles as man knows them, this equation seems to satisfy this paradoxical dilemma. Is light or any other electromagnetic radiation a wave, or is it a particle? Is it a little bullet of some kind traveling through space, or is it a wave? This equation is used in complex formulation of things that usually go by the heading of quantum mechanics. Theoretical chemists and physicists get into this field. Quantum mechanics. Now, if that isn't sufficient of a complication to file things up, to not know whether anything is a particle or whether it's a wave, and then to arbitrarily get a new equation that relates mass to wavelength, consider the other thing you have to do if you want to really get things down tight. You have to consider Einstein's theory of relativity. Now, this is a very complex subject. I know some of the things about relativity, but I'm by no means an expert in the field. It's such a complex subject that you would have to, if you wanted this as your area of research or the place where you were really smart, you would get a PhD in physics with a minor in mathematics, and you would do your research in the field of relativity for a period of about 5 years, and then you might be smart enough to converse with the other guys who work in the field of relativity. Now, there's certain consequences from the theory of relativity, though, that all chemists and all physicists understand. And one of them is this, that mass, and I'm going to put weight in parentheses because most of us know what the word weight means. Mass, for most purposes, is the same. Mass increases with speed. And speed is a more scientific term for speed is velocity. We should say the velocity of the automobile is 55 miles an hour, instead of saying the speed of the automobile. They mean the same thing. Now, the people who work in high-energy physics and take electrons and accelerate them to high velocity, like the Stanford Linear Accelerator near Palo Alto, they take an electron and they, with electric and magnetic fields, they get it moving. The principle is exactly the same as in your television tube. In your television tube, electrons are accelerated towards the screen, and it's electrons hitting the screen that create the light that you see, the reds, the blues, and all the colors. That electron moves so fast and scans back and forth so fast, your eye is not aware of all what it is doing. But the electron is actually accelerated many millions of miles an hour, actually, in your TV tube towards the screen. Now you carry that out in linear accelerators, or betatrons, or bevatrons, or a lot of other kinds of gadgets that scientists have invented. The electron increases in mass. And I believe that, and other scientists believe that, because there are ways of measuring that. And in theory, as an electron approaches the velocity of light, c, its mass would become infinite. Now, all of these things, relativity, the fact that you don't know whether it's a particle or whether it's a wave, enter in to the problems of just what an atom is like. Now, I'm talking to you about electrons, protons, and neutrons. But a very pure mathematical type scientist would not worry too much about that. And he would write mathematical equations so he wouldn't have any paradoxes of the mind. It's all in the mathematics. Brother Williams.
Could we back up just a little bit? He said that as a thing approaches the speed of light, then its mass is going to become infinite.
Mm-hmm.
Would that mean that the particle theory of light wouldn't work because light's supposed to go with the speed of light? I mean, light.
Well,
you're
all tied up in the dilemma, the paradox. You see, if you consider an electron as a particle, it can stand still, actually, or it can go any speed. But if you consider something as a wave, it has to go the speed of light. Don't ask me why, so I don't know. These concepts have been developed by scientists, and it fits the pattern of things. All of these have developed. Most of them have developed as a result of experiment. You do an experiment, you got to explain it somehow. And explain to a mathematician, or a scientist usually means to write some mathematics about it.
Well, if you were to accelerate, say, a hydrogen atom, accelerator, would they be trying to find out whether that would increase its mass by going faster?
It will. Every particle that man has ever accelerated in an accelerator increases its mass.
How fast can they get?
Oh, about 90% of the speed of light. And that's one thing that keeps them from accelerating that many faster. Now, I don't want to give you too much physics, but force is equal to the mass times the acceleration. If you have a little tiny car, like a new rabbit, and had a Ford V8 440 cubic inch engine, and then the axles and everything would stand it, you know you could accelerate rapidly, couldn't you? You could get that thing up to 100 miles an hour in 3 seconds, probably. But if you put that same V8 engine in a huge Lincoln Continental that weighs 8,000 pounds, it will take you 10 seconds to accelerate up to that. Well, it takes energy to accelerate these particles, and as they increase in mass, it takes more and more energy to accelerate them. Now, you have to realize that they're accelerating these things from just maybe 2,000 or 3,000 miles an hour ambient condition up to millions times millions of miles an hour. And so at those accelerations, it takes energy, and I'm talking about the energy required to light a city. They've just got a little tiny particle in their machine, and yet they're putting a city's worth of, they're putting probe power, a little substance station, into accelerating this tiny particle. And the reason they can't get it going any faster, and there's limitation to it, is because its mass is constantly increasing, and it's harder and harder to accelerate it, just like it's harder to accelerate a big car than a tiny car. Same identical principle.
But don't you just accelerate at once? I mean, don't you just give it a push? And
no, it's like a rocket. You accelerate, you constantly accelerate it. See?
Oh.
If you just give something a push, it'll go up to a given constant speed. Say there's no friction, then it'll keep going with that uniform velocity. But if you want to keep going faster and faster and faster, There's a constant force that you have to exert on this basic equation, do this right and do.
The force is equal to the mass times the acceleration.
Well, let me make a kind of a comment here that's always been interesting to me. Scientists in the past, not so much today, depends on the science, but in the past, some scientists have been very critical of religion because of their paradoxical concepts. Particularly some of the Protestant concepts, like the Father, the Son, the Holy Ghost are all the same person, all that, you know, the Nicene Creed business. Well, I can be critical of that too, but they've been more critical of other things too, seemingly paradoxical. And yet sciences are full of paradoxes that a scientist should never criticize religion on the ground that there are some things, even take the Negro question, which many people say, you know, that's so paradoxical, that just can't be. Well, you know, it may depend on whether you live today or yesterday or whether you have an eternal view or whatnot. It's hard to know on some of these things. But science is loaded with paradoxes. It's built around paradoxes. It's also built on unprovable postulates. If you take a purist approach to science, it is not an experimental approach. If you're a high-powered, theoretical, quantum mechanical, mathematically minded scientist, you base your science on five postulates, known as the five postulates of quantum mechanics. And then, as these postulates form a base, you invent and develop a lot of concepts, these and many more included, that include complicated second-order differential equations, get into the field of group theory, tensors, and all complicated things. And it's more paradoxical than religion could ever be, really. And yet guys base their faith on their science. Well, I brought this up just to tell you that our picture of a nucleus here, an electron out here for our simplest atom, and in more complicated atoms, we have a nucleus here that may have 10 protons in it, and maybe 13 neutrons, and 13 electrons out here somewhere, in orbits, like the planets going around the sun. It's probably not a true picture. But we only use it because it has some utility and is useful. The mathematical purist says that there's a statistical possibility, probability in the gym. I haven't mentioned that. Okay, we have the issue of not knowing whether it's a particle or knowing that it's a wave. But now we have the issue of not even knowing where the particle or the wave is located. Now, how definite can you get? Probability enters in such that you do not know where the electron is located. It might at any given instant be at the center of the nucleus, or it might be out of the infinity. The probability function goes by a symbol called psi. And this probability function is sometimes called the wave function, although you might as well have called it the mass function, because it involves de Broglie's idea that particles and waves are equated through this kind of an equation. Now, I studied under a theoretical chemist, Henry Irons, but I haven't used my quantum mechanics very much in the past 30 years. 35 years. So I don't know whether I can write down the equation out of my head or not. Probably the last time I used it was 30 years ago. But the equation is something like this. The second derivative of psi
with respect to a dimension in the x direction, plus the second derivative of psi with respect to the y direction, plus the second derivative of this probability function with respect to the z direction. Now that takes care of all physical space, x, y, and z. Is equal to some energy times a complicated function known as h. Now, that thing is a mathematical thing that comes out of these five postulates of quantum mechanics. And in theory, and the high power theoreticians believe this, it's the religion. If they can't do it because the computers are not smart enough yet. They say someday they will be smart enough. But they believe that all science is contained in this differential equation. It's all there. It's all in that. Well, now, having taken this detour, just to show you the indefiniteness that science has concerning what an atom is like, we will go back to this picture of an atom that we started out with, just because it's useful. It probably is not true, but it is useful in our thinking. Okay, we'll go back to hydrogen. It has a proton and an electron. We'll temporarily forget about the isotopes that we discussed before. Negative charge here, one positive charge there. We come to helium, which is element number 2 in the periodic table. It will have 2 protons, and it will have 2 neutrons. There will be a plus 2 charge on the nucleus, and up here there will be 2 electrons, each one with 1 negative charge, and the whole atom is neutral. We come to element number 3, which is lithium. It will have 3 protons, and I don't know how many neutrons. It'll have enough to make it up to its approximate atomic weight. What is that? 7. So it'll have 3 protons and 4 neutrons. It'll be a plus 3 charge, and then it will have those same 2 electrons out here in what is called the K shell. This is called the K orbital, or chemists will also use the word shell interchangeably with the word orbital. This is still the K orbit, this is still the K orbit, but now an electron appears out here at a greater distance in what is called the L shell, or the L orbital. Now we come to beryllium, which is element number 4, and we will have 4 protons, and we'll have enough neutrons to make up its approximate atomic weight, which seems to be somewhere around 9, so it means we have about 5 neutrons. Then we would have this L shell, K shell, with its 2 electrons, and we would have the L shell with 2 electrons. And you can continue this process. Now, know that the number of electrons equals the thing we call atomic number. It goes by symbol capital Z. The atomic number in your periodic chart that you got at the bookstore is the number 1, 2, 3. Some charts have it above the element, some below. 4, 5, 6. Notice how it just increases through the chart. You go across the top, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10, 11, 12, 13, right on and on, row after row. That also equals the number of protons.
The number of protons in the nucleus must equal the number of electrons out here in these shells or in these orbitals external to the nucleus. There is a thing given by the symbol A that is called the mass number. And that equals the number of neutrons plus the number of protons. And it's the nearest whole number. We ignore isotopes. So for manganese with a weight of 54.9 and an atomic number of 25, we call that 55. That would be A, the mass number. And the atomic number was 25, so that's Z. And you subtract this from that and you get 30, and that's the number of neutrons in the nucleus of that particular atom. The K shell can have a maximum number of electrons of 2. The L shell can have a maximum number of electrons of 8. And the M shell can have a maximum number of electrons of 18. And the KLM N shell, I think is 32, and so on. And I forgot the rule that expresses it. What does it look like? It looks like it's 2n squared, I think. 2n squared. K can also be called principal quantum number 1, principal quantum number 2, principal quantum number 3, and principal quantum number 4. So, if n is 1, Cn squared is still 1, so the maximum number would be 2. If n is 2, n squared is 4, and the maximum number would be 8. If n is 3, n squared is 9, and 2 times 9 would be 18. And if n is 4, n squared is 16, and 2 times 16 is 32. So I was wrong. As you build elements mentally, then, by adding more protons and more neutrons to the nucleus and more electrons outside, the electrons have to go in these different levels, K, L, M, and N. Now, I don't want to get you too involved with that, but I want to go to a more useful kind of a designation relating to the energy of electrons that chemists use. The electrons are the things that matter, and the energy that they have, and the shells or atomic orbitals that they belong to, are important to the properties, particularly the periodic properties of the elements. Electrons are designated by 4 quantum numbers. These quantum numbers can be regarded as the address of the electrons. It's just like my address is, for my home, is 1711 North Lambert Lane. There's no other such address in Probe. Each electron has an address. The first quantum number is called the principal quantum number. And you can designate that as K-L-M-N-O, capital letters. But more frequently, you simply use 1 to mean K, 2 to mean L, 3 to mean M, and 4 to mean N. And they continue on O, P, Q. So that's the first thing in the address, defining an electron. The electron has its own individuality, just as we have. All right, the second thing is called the subsidiary quantum number. Subsidiary quantum number. That is designated by the lowercase letters S, P, D, or F. It's a historical thing that you use these. Spectroscopy, you know, we had this thing that we looked through and tried to see the lines from all those emanating from those various gaseous elements. If you do that scientifically, that's called spectroscopy. You record the data on photographic film, and the spectroscopist referred to lines as being sharp. What P stand for? D was diffuse, and F was fine, and P, I don't know what P stood for, but anyway, it's a historical accident that they use this designation. By the way, you can tell what the quantum numbers of electrons are through spectroscopy. Accurate spectroscopy. And the quantum theory came as a result of trying to explain certain things about spectroscopy. The third quantum number is called the magnetic quantum number. These are the individual definitions. The general thing. Well, you go from the general to the specific. Staying general, we call this N. And N can be K, L, M, N, or corresponding to 1, 2, 3, 4. We call this L. And L can have the value of S, P, D, F, and so on. The magnetic quantum number we call lowercase m. And it can have values which depend on these values. It starts out at L minus 1 and on down to L. And these are minus numbers. And then it goes on down to 0. And then it increases up to L plus 1, where these are positive numbers. Don't worry about this too much. It will seem hard to sum up. Then the last quantum number is called the spin quantum number. That goes by the symbol S, and it's lowercase, and one has to be careful to not confuse the spin quantum number with a subsidiary quantum number S. That sometimes happens in science, that they use the same symbol for two different things. And you have to be careful to not mix them up. The spin quantum number can have a value of plus 1/2 or of minus 1/2. These things can be used in that equation that I wrote out here for certain purposes in science. It's very complex. All right, let's go back to our atoms. The hydrogen atom contains a single electron. The principal quantum number of that electron is 1. The subsidiary quantum number is s. And we designate that in the s orbital there is only 1 electron. The magnetic quantum number of that thing is 0, and a spin quantum number can be either 1, plus 1 half, or minus 1 half, and you do not know which one it is.
Now, does the spin quantum number tell you which way the
electron is? No, it's either spinning to the right or spinning to the left. Opposite spin. Question?
How do you find the mass number?
The mass number is the number of protons plus the number of neutrons.
So you started out with the number, then you subtracted the...
I started out with the mass number and I subtracted the atomic number.
Where did you get the mass number?
From the atomic weight chart. Doesn't yours have it?
It's the biggest.
It's the weight. It's the atomic weight. The mass. And I rounded it off to the closest whole valued number. Now, if this excites some of you so that you just can't stand it, just get a freshman chemistry book, almost any freshman chemistry book, and look in the section on atomic theory or the nature of the atom. Atomic structure. The chapter on it will have some such title. Atomic structure, atomic theory, something along that line. Now, we will not, for chemistry, get involved with all this stuff. I'm just telling you it's there. Now, when we meet Monday, I want to teach you about the spectroscopic notation. Spectroscopic notation or nomenclature for the electrons in atoms. So if you want